The next organ system to study is the respiratory system. And we should talk a little bit about the major functions. First, it's kind of a confusing name because respiration refers to multiple things. Cellular respiration is not what we're talking about here. That occurs inside cells. Respiration, the use of the word respiration for this organ system really refers to the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide, meaning they get swapped. And that's a major function of the system. Breathing is all about that. Now, what we call breathing can also be called ventilation, because that's what's happening at the lungs. The lungs fill with air. There is an exchange of carbon dioxide and oxygen that occurs at the lungs, and that is called external respiration. So that's a major function. And then air is expelled from the lungs. So there's inhalation and exhalation, which collectively is ventilation. That obviously is a major function of the respiratory system, but it's not the only thing that the system does. It's also involved in maintaining blood pressure. There's a kind of a complex thing that happens there. And it's used for things other than breathing. For instance, I'm delivering this lecture because of the respiratory system. Speaking is a function of the respiratory system. You can also do things like blow on someone, blow a fly off of your arm. That requires the respiratory system as well. Let's look at the major anatomy in this slide one. Obviously, there are the lungs. Those are the most important organs of the respiratory system, but they wouldn't do any good unless you had the plumbing connected to the lungs. And that plumbing starts really at the nose and mouth. Obviously, you can breathe through the nose, but you can breathe through your mouth as well. So the nasal cavity and the oral cavity are really parts of the respiratory system. We think of the oral cavity as part of the digestive system, which it is, but this is an overlap. The oral cavity is also part of the respiratory system. They both lead to the same place, which is the pharynx, the throat we've talked about. So the pharynx is also part of the digestive system and also part of the respiratory system. When you breathe in, whether it's from the mouth or the nose, though, the air gets passed through the pharynx to the larynx first, which is the very superior part of the trachea. The larynx leads to the trachea, which is the windpipe. You can see it opened up here in cross section, but here it is in full view. And that trachea then bifurcates or splits into two, which makes sense because there are two lungs. So the single trachea splits into two bronchi. There are different kinds of bronchi. The primary in bronchi is the plural of bronchus, so one of them is called a bronchus. But primary bronchi there's two of those, one for each lung. They split directly from the trachea, and you don't see further splits, but each primary bronchus then splits into secondary bronchi, which then split into tertiary bronchi, even smaller. And then the tertiary bronchi split yet again, this is all happening inside the lung then, into even smaller tubes called bronchioles. And then there are several different splits. We still call them bronchioles, but every time they divide, they're getting smaller and smaller tubing. And then eventually we'll get to the ends of that so-called tree. It's kind of like a tree because the trachea is the trunk, and then primary bronchi are the branches. It keeps branching and branching, and then eventually we'll get to the ends of those trees later on. But that's all part of the airway. The airway involves not only the nose and mouth and the pharynx, but also this this bronchial tree or respiratory tree that keeps subdividing. The lungs themselves are enclosed. We've talked about this before. Each one is enclosed by its own serous membrane called a pleura, and that's because the lungs are highly mobile. They move around as they inflate and deflate, and that would rub them raw if it weren't for the fact that they're covered by a serous membrane to lubricate them. Let's go to the second slide and look at a sagittal section. Now, this is very similar to a picture we looked at in the digestive system chapter, for good reason, because of what I was saying. They share some structures, so we won't go through that again, but let's pay attention to the nasal cavity here, which we haven't really talked about. The nasal cavity is is lined by epithelium, but notice that there are major folds, and we're only looking at one side because this is a cut right down the middle. It's not only sagittal, it's a mid-sagittal section or median section. And there are three major folds called nasal conchae. So a superior, a middle, and an inferior nasal concha, the singular of conchae, on each side. And those nasal conchae cause turbulence in the air as it's inspired or inhaled through the nose. And that turbulence makes it much more likely that the air will come into contact with this moist epithelium. So because of the nasal conchae, the air that's fairly dry, that's drawn in, will get a good chance of being exposed to the moist epithelium, and therefore the air will be humidified before it's drawn into the lungs. And this keeps the lungs from drying out. On the way back out, during exhalation, the reverse happens. So the swirling that happens in here will cause a lot of evaporation of, I'm sorry, not evaporation, a lot of condensation of water. It evaporates on the way in. The moisture on the nasal epithelium evaporates into the air. That's what humidifies it. On the way back out, the air condenses its water vapor back onto the epithelium. And this is important because otherwise you would lose all that water as you exhale it. Of course, we do lose water when we exhale, but we don't lose nearly as much because first, a lot of that water that was evaporated from the epithelium on the way in gets condensed, which is the opposite of evaporation. It's like dew forming, and that puts it back onto the moist epithelium, and therefore not nearly as much as water is left in the breath as we exhale. Saves us a lot of water. The rest of the material on this is really review, except I'll have a better view of the pharynx in the next slide. In slide 3, we can see the pharynx divided into its three areas. We talked about these areas in the digestive system chapter, but here they are actually shown in different colors. The nasopharynx is the part of the pharynx that opens up to the nasal cavity. The oropharynx is the part of the pharynx that opens up to the oral cavity. And then the laryngopharynx is the, in terms of inspired air, incoming air, it's the last part of the pharynx. It's the part that opens up into the larynx, which is sits right above the trachea. Slide 4. Notice how this is cut right here in the overall view. This is a transverse cut right through the trachea. And it's not only cutting through the trachea, this is the front, notice, but also it's cutting through the tube that lies just posterior to the trachea. This is the trachea. This is the esophagus. So those two major tubes run down the mediastinum between the two lungs in the thorax. But notice there's a big difference between the trachea, which is one tube, the airway, and the esophagus, which is a different tube, the passageway for food and drink. I actually talked about this a little bit in the digestive system chapter as well, but you get a good view of it here. The trachea has to remain open all the time. You don't want the airway to collapse. You need continuous air. And that's why it's built kind of like a dryer hose. This blue that you see is a C-shaped, not a total ring, but a partial ring, a C-shaped cartilage. And there are many of these. That's what gives the trachea its ridged appearance in the overall view. And they keep the trachea opened up. There's always an open lumen in the trachea. So that's why I say it's kind of like a dryer hose. In a dryer hose, it's a spiral of wire, but here you have individual C-shaped cartilages. On the other hand, the esophagus does not need to be open all the time. You only want the esophagus to be open while it's being used, which is during deglutition or swallowing. And so usually it just collapses and is nice and compact. And during swallowing, it gets forced open by the food bolus. You wouldn't want that to have to be the case for the trachea, though. One thing I didn't say about slide 4 is that you can get a good view of something else I've talked about multiple times in this course, and that's that the cells that make up the epithelium lining the trachea produce mucus, and they have cilia. The mucus is sticky, and so it catches dust particles and bacteria, things that you don't really want to put into your lungs. And the cilia beat back and forth, and anything that's captured by the sticky mucus gets swept superiorly up from where it came toward the mouth, toward the pharynx, and you're continuously swallowing debris that's caught by the trachea, and you put that debris into the stomach where it's disposed of, basically. And also, anything living, you know, bacteria that might hurt you, when they get swallowed, most of those can't survive the high acidity of the stomach. Now we can go to slide 5. And there's a couple points to make on this slide. One is that each lung overall is subdivided into lobes. But notice that there are 3 lobes on the right lung, whereas the left lung is made up of only 2 lobes. It makes sense that the left lung has only 2 lobes because it's slightly smaller overall than the right lung, and that's because of the slightly asymmetrical placement of the heart. The heart's apex, which is its tip, juts leftward, and therefore the heart takes up more room in the left side of the thorax than it does in the right side of the thorax, and therefore the left lung is slightly smaller. It's made up of only 2 lobes. Now, you can tell in a dissection one lobe from the other because they are separated by what are called fissures, a word that just means crack. And so there are, since the right lung has 3 lobes, there are 2 fissures to separate those 3 lobes. The horizontal fissure separates the right superior lobe from the middle lobe on the right. And then the oblique fissure, because it's kind of diagonally placed, separates the right lung's middle lobe from the inferior lobe. There is no middle lobe on the left lung, so it's only the left superior and the left inferior lobes, and they are separated by a single fissure, which is the oblique fissure on the left. Inferior to the lungs is a powerful muscle called the diaphragm. And the diaphragm is just like any other muscle. It can only contract actively, so it can only shorten. It can't actively expand. And when it contracts, it increases its archedness. Notice it's kind of arch-shaped. It decreases its archedness. This is in a relaxed state. When it contracts, it pulls downward. This whole arch kind of straightens out. And that's what happens during inspiration or inhalation. Those two words really mean the same thing, when you're breathing inward. But the reverse of that is not an active process. The diaphragm when it relaxes, will not push upward actively. It resumes this arched shape because that's its relaxed shape, because of the connective tissues that are connected to it. Kind of its elastic recoil, basically. Now, so in other words, what I'm saying here is that when you blow outward, it's not because your diaphragm is involved. Your diaphragm just relaxes, and that it simply resumes this shape. More about forced expiration a little bit later, though. In this little inset right here, notice the arrangement of the lungs with respect to the pleura and to the ribs, and the muscles between the ribs. The muscles between the ribs are called intercostal muscles. Costal means of the ribs, therefore intercostal means between ribs. Situated between the muscles of the rib cage and the lungs themselves is the pleura for each lung. And like I said, that's a serous membrane, and you're accustomed to serous membranes having two layers. So there's a parietal pleura and a visceral pleura. Those are the two layers of the overall pleura. And just for as for any other serous membrane, between those two layers, the parietal and visceral layer, is serous fluid. Well, the serous fluid is called the pleural fluid in the special case of the pleura. It's still serous fluid, but we call it pleural fluid, and that's what fills the pleural cavity between those two layers. Now, it's not a very thick layer. In other words, the visceral and parietal pleura are very close to each other all the time in a normal human. In fact, if you puncture it, the pleura, and get air in there, that's going to disallow the lung from being pulled on, and you can no longer inflate that lung. So that's a problem. You don't want that to happen normally. The two layers of the pleura are very close to each other, and there's only a very thin layer of pleural fluid. Now, the reason that's important is because pleural fluid is liquid, and liquid is uncompressible and unexpandable. Unlike gas, for instance, if you have gas in a chamber and you make the chamber bigger, the gas just expands, or if you pressurize it, the gas will compress. That's not true with a liquid, though. So this is really important to ventilation. When the ribs get moved during inspiration, and we'll look at this again in a different slide, but what happens is that the muscles move these ribs superiorly and a little bit laterally. They're moving in kind of a diagonal direction, just like my cursor is right here. And when that happens, that's going to pull on the parietal layer of the pleura, which is then going to pull on the pleural fluid. Since it's not a gas, it won't just expand, it's liquid. So it gets pulled along for a ride with the parietal pleura, and therefore the pleural fluid then pulls on the visceral pleura, and since the visceral pleura is connected directly to the lung surface, that will pull on the lung itself. And therefore, the end result of the ribs being pulled upward is that the lungs will be pulled into a bigger volume. They will expand. And this is necessary for air to enter the lungs. But I'll talk a little bit more about what's happening pressure-wise in a different slide. This is all I really want to cover on that slide. Let's look at a different view in slide 6. Notice this is another transverse cut, and it's cut right near the top or the base of the heart. The base of the heart is where all the major arteries are. We've talked about those before, and arteries and veins, really. But anyway, the apex extends down diagonally. Right here is the apex. This is the base where it's being cut. And notice that this cut is below the trachea. The trachea ends when it bifurcates, which is where the two primary bronchi start. And that's really above this cut, which is why we don't see the trachea in this view. Instead, the cut has been below the bifurcation point, which is why we see one cut through one primary bronchus and a cut through the other primary bronchus. So this, since this is the back, the posterior, and this is the front, this is going to be the left primary bronchus, and this one's going to be the right primary bronchus. I shouldn't say it's going to be, it is. Okay, anyway, that's why you see esophagus, but you don't see trachea. The trachea ended when it split into these two primary bronchi. Now to slide 7. Now we get a good view of the tree I was talking about. So a primary bronchus separates in, or splits into secondary bronchi, which split into tertiary bronchi, which then split into bronchioles, and then they keep splitting into smaller and smaller bronchioles until you finally get to the tips of this tree, one little piece of which we see right here. Eventually, the smaller and smaller bronchioles split into branches that are called terminal bronchioles. Now, terminal means end, but it's really not the end of the splitting. The reason these are called the terminal bronchioles is because they are at the end of the so-called conducting zone. So the overall tree consists of the conducting zone and the respiratory zone. The conducting zone is all about just moving air. That's what conduct means. So air gets moved in and out through the conducting zone, which includes the trachea and all of the bronchi and all of the bronchioles up to and including the terminal bronchioles. No gas exchange takes place here. It's just moving the gas in and out of the tree. Then the terminal bronchioles divide into even smaller ones that are called respiratory bronchioles, and they're called respiratory bronchioles because gas exchange does occur there. So the respiratory bronchioles can exchange gas because they are lined by epithelium that are richly vascularized, meaning they are surrounded by blood vessels. You don't see the blood vessels in this view just for simplicity, but they are there. And so gas exchange takes place in the respiratory bronchioles. It does not take place in the terminal bronchioles. And the respiratory bronchioles are fitted with a bunch of tiny sacs called alveoli. That's a plural of alveolus, which would, if you're just referring to one of them. And these little sac-like alveoli drastically increase the surface area rather than beyond what it would be if the lung is just a sac. So don't think of the lung as an empty sac. That's not it at all. It's much more like a sponge made up of thousands and thousands of tiny little sacs called alveoli. And so each alveolus has its own surface area. When you add all of those together, you come up with a lot more surface area than you would have if the lung were just an empty sac with one surface. And that's important because the more surface area you have, the more gas exchange can take place. And often books will say that the overall surface area of all the alveoli in both lungs is roughly equivalent to the surface area of a tennis court, just to give you an idea. That's a lot of surface area for gas exchange. Now we look in slide 8, we're looking at even closer detail of these alveoli, and some of them are cut open here. You can see that they're connected to each other by little alveolar pores. And each of these little dots is a nucleus of one cell, so you can see that the lining of each alveolus is an epithelium. These are epithelial cells making up that epithelium. And so these are at the very ends of the overall respiratory tree. Okay, now to slide 9. This is kind of the same view, but even closer. So these are alveolar pores. This is one alveolus. And now you can see a clear view of each of the individual cells making up the epithelium of the alveolus. There are a couple major kinds of cells that line the alveolus. Most of them are the ones that are in kind of yellowish tan colored here with a purple, purplish nucleus. Those are the so-called type 1 alveolar cells. They are squamous epithelial cells. And you know that squamous already, you know that those are flat, scale-like cells. Sometimes these are called, these are likened to fried eggs because they're about as flat as they can be for most of the cell. That would be the white of the fried egg. And then they're a little thicker right where the nucleus is simply because the nucleus takes up room. So if you were looking on at these on edge, which you don't, well, that's kind of an on-edge view right there. It kind of looks like a fried egg where the nucleus is the yolk. Now, it's important for these things to be flat, they're squamous, because the gas exchange that's taking place here happens by diffusion. And diffusion is passive transport. It works wonderfully well if you're talking only about very small distances. And therefore, for diffusion to work well, the distance has to be minimized. That's why the lining of the alveoli is not only squamous, but it's simple squamous. So the cell is, there's only one layer of cells, that makes it thinner, and the cells themselves are as thin as they can be. Before we get to the gas exchange, though, let's talk about the other kind of cell that you see here and there. These are the ones that are greenish in this figure. They are not about gas exchange, they are about secreting what is called surfactant. Surfactant is a wetting agent that minimizes the surface tension. If it weren't for that, then these alveoli, which are tiny, would fill up with droplets of water, and it would make them much harder to open up because of the surface tension. So that's what the surfactant is, which is, surfactant is kind of like soap. It reduces the surface tension and therefore makes expansion of the alveoli much easier. The darker purpled ones are macrophages. So they're not staying in place. These macrophages are crawling around continuously looking for things that shouldn't be there. Macrophages are cells that undergo phagocytosis. So they're surveilling the area looking for things that shouldn't be there. If they find them, they will engulf them by phagocytosis and protect you. The red, notice, are cutaway views of blood capillaries. So it's important for each alveolus to be surrounded by blood capillaries because the gas exchange that I keep talking about happens between the air in the lungs and the blood in the capillaries. And so that's what we see a close-up in the circle to the right of slide 9. The respiratory membrane is what the two different gases, oxygen and carbon dioxide, have to cross in order for this gas exchange to take place. And importantly, what one gas is doing does not at all affect what the other gas is doing. They are independently moving. So I say that they're swapped, but that just happens to be the case that they both are moving, but they're moving independently. Each gas, oxygen and carbon dioxide, is moving down its own gradient. And that's how diffusion always works, down a gradient. From, in this case, it's a gradient of partial pressure is what we call it. Oxygen is moving from high partial pressure to low partial pressure, and so is carbon dioxide. But when air that's in the, or not when, air that's in the lungs, in the alveolus, has a higher partial pressure of oxygen, or in other words, the oxygen's partial pressure is higher in the air in the lungs than it is in the blood. And so when oxygen diffuses, it's going to diffuse from high partial pressure in the lung to lower partial pressure in the blood. It's just the opposite situation for carbon dioxide. There is a higher partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the blood than there is in the lung. So when it diffuses, not having anything to do with oxygen, it's going to go down its own partial pressure gradient from high partial pressure in the blood to lower partial pressure in the lungs. Okay, so those happen at the same time, but they both have to get through, even though they're going in opposite directions, they both have to get through this respiratory membrane, which has three major parts to it. And so let's talk about this in terms of an oxygen molecule, because it's going to move in one direction. The three parts in order that an oxygen encounters, the three parts of the respiratory membrane, are made up of the type 1 squamous epithelial cells making up the lining of the alveolus. And then there is a basement membrane. Remember when we were talking about tissues in general that I said that any given epithelium is built on a layer of connective tissue called a basement membrane. So this is the basement membrane for the epithelium lining the alveolus, but it's also the same basement membrane for the epithelium lining making up the wall of the capillary. So there's two epithelia here. There's an endothelium, which is the epithelium making up the wall of the blood capillary, and there's an epithelium of the alveolus. They share the same basement membrane. And so those are the three parts: the alveolar epithelium, the fused basement membrane, and the capillary epithelium all make up collectively the respiratory membrane. And so it happens in a fraction of a second, but the oxygen, if you consider just a single oxygen molecule, it has to go through quite a bit. It's actually more than just the respiratory membrane. First, it's in the air in the lung. The oxygen molecule is just part of that air mixture. It then has to travel through the plasma membrane on one side of this epithelial cell of the alveolus. Once it gets inside the cell, then it has to diffuse through the cytosol, which is the liquid interior of that cell. It then gets to the plasma membrane on the other side of that same cell and has to go through that phospholipid bilayer that makes up that plasma membrane. Now it's outside of the alveolus and therefore outside of the lung. It's also, though, outside of the blood capillary. It hasn't entered the capillary yet. It has to diffuse through that basement membrane, and then it has to diffuse through the phospholipid bilayer that makes up the plasma membrane on one side of the cell that makes up the lining of this blood capillary. Now it is inside that cell, the cell making up the wall of the capillary. Then it has to diffuse through the cytosol, which is the liquid interior of that blood capillary's cell, until it reaches the other side. The other side of the cell is made up of phospholipid bilayer. It's going to have to pass through that as well. Now it's outside of that blood capillary wall's cell, and it is inside the blood. But it's not inside a blood cell yet. It's just in the plasma. Remember, whole blood is made up of blood cells and liquid plasma that surrounds those cells. Right now, the oxygen molecule is in the plasma, and it has to diffuse through that plasma until it encounters a red blood cell, or an erythrocyte, just another name for a red blood cell. Remember, they are biconcave discs. And now that's another cell it has to enter into, so it has to go through the phospholipid bilayer of the plasma membrane surrounding the red blood cell, and now it's inside the cell, it's in the cytosol of the red blood cell. It will diffuse through that cytosol until it encounters a hemoglobin molecule. Just a single red blood cell is full of millions of different hemoglobin molecules. Each individual hemoglobin molecule can attach to and therefore carry up to 4 oxygen molecules. So when it finally latches onto a hemoglobin molecule, then it's ready for its trip around the body as this red blood cell travels along with as part of blood. So it's pretty, even though it happens very quickly, it's pretty complex. Let's go to slide 9 now and talk more about ventilation. If you look at the arrangement of the rib cage, the ribs are kind of diagonally placed. They kind of hang diagonally downward. They're a little bit like, imagine a wire handle for a bucket. And it's a kind of bucket that has a handle that's big enough so that when it's all the way to the side, it falls down kind of halfway down the bucket. That's kind of what the ribs are like. And if you imagine lifting that handle of the bucket, as you do so, it's going to move it more to the side, right? And that's what's shown here in the right side of slide 10. If you let these fall, the distance between them two, right and left, is going to decrease. This is like two handles of two buckets. But when you pull them both upward, and they're both horizontal, now they're maximally spaced apart. So this is what happens when the external intercostal muscles contract. I mentioned intercostal muscles earlier, but there's two types. External intercostal muscles are called external because they are superficial to the other ones, which are called internal intercostals. Here we're looking at external intercostals. And if we were to remove those, we would see the internal intercostals immediately deep to them. So it's two layers of muscle. But only the external intercostals of those two kinds of intercostal muscles, only the external intercostal muscles contract during inspiration, when you're taking in a breath, inward, when you're inhaling. And they are arranged between the ribs. When they contract, one rib will be pulled upward toward the rib above it. And therefore, the same thing is happening on all of them. They will all get lifted like handles of buckets. And this, notice, increases the width of the rib cage overall. At the same time, the sternum gets pulled anteriorly. That's what this blue arrow on the right refers to. So overall, the rib cage gets wider, and it also gets deeper front to back. And therefore, the volume of the lungs, because they're getting pulled along for the ride, like I said earlier, since they're connected to the pleura, all the rib cage, as it expands, it's pulling on the pleura then pulls on the lungs. And as the volume of the rib cage is increased during inspiration, the volume of the lungs is increased. And the lungs are chambers filled with gas, which is expandable and compressible. So just imagine any chamber of filled with gas. If you increase the volume of that chamber, what's going to happen to the pressure in there? Well, the pressure is going to go down, right? And that's what happens because of the contraction of the external intercostal muscles, causing an increase in volume. When the volume increases, the pressure inside the lungs gets lower. Now, there is air pressure outside as well, caused by the gravity pulling on all of the air outside. So the barometric pressure is the air pressure. It changes value throughout the day. But when you hear that on a weather report, the barometric pressure, that is the pressure outside. When you move these muscles and increase the volume of the rib cage, and therefore increase the volume of the lungs, and therefore decrease the pressure in the lungs, that actually drops the pressure in the lungs so that it's lower than atmospheric or barometric pressure. As soon as it's lower than barometric pressure, then the higher pressure outside forces air into your lungs. So we kind of like to think that we're sucking air in. Really what we're doing is increasing the volume until the pressure gets low enough so that atmospheric pressure outside forces the air into our lungs. Okay, so that's happening because of external intercostal muscles, not shown here, it is shown. At the same time, the diaphragm will contract, and like I said earlier, when it contracts, it goes from being more arched to less arched, more straight. And it, since it forms the floor, that means you are dropping the floor. So at the same time that the thorax is getting wider and deeper front to back, it's also getting taller top to bottom because the floor is being dropped. And that will also increase the volume. So all of it helps out in bringing the pressure to lower than atmospheric pressure. That's what forces the air into your lungs. Now we see the opposite happening in slide 11. When you've reached the top of that inhalation, and you now exhale. And exhalation, normal and a normal exhalation, you don't really have to use muscles to do this. You can simply relax the external intercostals and relax the diaphragm, so there's no muscular exertion necessary. They will and then because of elastic recoil, everything will go back into its original place. The diaphragm will go back to its arched position, and the ribs will fall a little bit, and this has the effect of reversing everything we just talked about in the previous slide. So the rib cage gets narrower, right to left, it gets shallower, front to back, and it gets shorter, top to bottom. All of this will reduce the volume of the rib cage, and therefore of the lungs, and now the gas inside the lungs, the air, is going to be at a greater pressure because you're decreasing the volume. And when that pressure gets higher than atmospheric pressure outside, the gradient is reversed, basically, and therefore air travels from the higher pressure inside the lungs to the lower pressure outside. That's an exhalation. And both of these together, inspiration and expiration, make up ventilation. Now, that's what you do normally. You don't really exert yourself during expiration, but you can. It's possible to do that. And that's why you have internal intercostal muscles, which are not shown here, but they would be just on the other side of these external ones. When you force those to contract, or when you consciously do this, you're causing those to contract, that speeds up the ribs falling downward, because the muscles are actually pulling them downward. And so it happens a lot quicker. And therefore, you reverse the pressure much quicker, and you blow out with much greater force. At the same time, helping all of this, you contract your abdominal muscles. Your abdominal muscles, when they contract, will squeeze on your abdomen. Well, your abdomen is filled with various organs, intestines and other things, but they really are mostly liquid, and therefore when you press on them, since they're not gas, they don't just get smaller. They have to instead be pushed somewhere else, out of the way. And the only place that they can go really is upward. They get jammed upward into the diaphragm, and they really force that diaphragm upward quickly. And all of that will cause you to have a very forced expiration. You're blowing outward intentionally. We can see what's happening to the pressure and the volume in slide 12. This is what I was just talking about. During inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure, which simply is the word that means the pressure inside the lung, gets lower than the pressure outside. Zero here means this, it's the same as barometric pressure or atmospheric pressure. If it's at zero, it's the same. And when it's the same as atmospheric pressure, air is not coming into or out, going out of the lungs. But by increasing the volume, notice the volume is increasing here because the external intercostals are pulling the ribs upward, that's decreasing the pressure. So as your rib cage is still expanded, the reduction in pressure is going to bring in more and more air, and as that comes in, that's going to eventually equalize the pressure between outside and inside. That's at the very top of your breath. If you inhale and hold it there, it will come back to zero because eventually the pressure inside your lungs will be the same as outside. And then if you allow yourself to exhale, then that's going to decrease the volume again, and that's going to pressurize it. It's going to increase the pressure. That's what brings it above the level of the outside air, and that's what forces the air outward until it comes to equilibrium again. So this just keeps happening over and over as long as you keep breathing. Slide 13 is an explanation of different lung volumes and capacities that have different names and different definitions. First of all, let me distinguish between a volume and a capacity. Capacities are combinations of volumes. So each volume is a single volume defined as, I'll talk about in a second. But each capacity is the sum of multiple different volumes. So that's the difference between volume and capacity. Tidal volume is the volume of air that's moved in and out of the lungs in normal breathing. This means when you're just sitting there at rest. You still have to breathe, but the tidal volume is kind of the minimum breaths that you take, the volume of minimum inspiration and expiration. So, measured in milliliters on this graph, that's the tidal volume. In and out, in and out. Okay, and then you have what's called an inspiratory reserve volume. So in a normal breath, you know, when you get to the top of that inhalation, just a normal small breath, notice that if you wanted to, you could take a deeper breath. And however much additional air above how much you've taken in already in a normal breath, how much additional air you could take in is by itself called the inspiratory reserve volume. You have that much more ability on reserve that you could take in. Okay, so it's just from the top of the tidal volume trace up to the maximum amount you can take in. All right, now on the other side, after you've exhaled normally and you're just about to inhale again, well, you could force yourself to blow out more air than you've just exhaled. And so however much additional air you could exhale is called the expiratory reserve volume. And even when you have exhaled as deeply as you possibly can, you can't get any more air out of your lungs, there still is air in your lungs. You just cannot get it out. And that is called the residual volume. Residual means leftover. So there's always a liter or so of residual volume in your lungs, even after you've maximally exhaled. Okay, so those are the volumes. The vital capacity is the sum of inspiratory reserve volume, tidal volume, and expiratory reserve volume. In other words, it's the total amount of air that you can move in and out of your lungs. If you take in as deep a breath as you can, and then you exhale as deeply as you can. That's however much air you have moved is the vital capacity. It's the sum of all three volumes other than the residual volume. If you include the residual volume as well, the sum of all of it is the total lung capacity. So if you take in as deep a breath as possible, you are now containing all four of these volumes, which is the lung capacity. And that depends on the size of the person and depends on the sex. But the 6,000 milliliters here is just an average. Okay, slide 14. This table gives you examples of other reasons that we move air. And this isn't an exhaustive list because, for instance, forcefully blowing outward for whatever reason is not shown here. But, you know, for instance, you can do this to blow the candles out on a birthday cake, which, now that we're in this pandemic, you should rethink. It's always been a pretty stupid idea, and hopefully this pandemic will make it go away as a tradition. We shouldn't be blowing on the surface of a sticky cake and then having everyone else eat that. Anyway, forced expiration is a non-respiratory gas movement, so is coughing, sneezing, crying, laughing, having hiccups, and yawning. I should say, another one that's not shown here is speaking and singing. Those are both involve gas movements as well. Okay, slide 15. Now we're looking at kind of a plumbing diagram showing two different capillary beds. The one here around the alveoli. Now there's many, many capillary beds because there's many, many clusters of alveoli, but this one capillary bed at the alveolus, at these alveoli, represent all of the lung capillaries. And then everywhere else in the body, you have capillary beds as well. So this single capillary bed on the bottom of the figure represents all of the non-alveolar capillaries in the various tissues of the body. And gas exchange happens at both of those places, but it happens in opposite directions at the two different kinds of capillary beds. So let's start here at the upper left. This is inspired air, meaning air that's inhaled into the lungs. When you take in a breath before any gas exchange has taken place, there's quite a bit of oxygen in that air that you took in, and there's not all that much CO2. There's a little bit there because there's CO2 in the atmosphere, but there's not very much. Because the oxygen is so much higher than the oxygen in the blood, that's why there is a gradient. So this is oxygen in the inspired air. Well, there's also blood coming into the capillaries that surround these alveoli. And the blood doesn't have very much oxygen in it compared to the air. And that's because the oxygen has already been taken out of the blood by the tissues of the body. There still is some oxygen, though. It's just not as much as the oxygen that's in the air. And therefore, that's what defines the gradient for oxygen. Since oxygen is higher in the alveoli than it is in the blood, then oxygen is going to go down its gradient from the air in the alveoli into the blood in the capillary surrounding the alveoli. Okay? Meanwhile, at the same time, the carbon dioxide is pretty high in the blood that's coming back to the lungs, and that's because the CO2 has been delivered to that blood by the tissues in the rest of the body as a waste material. And so the CO2 is higher in the blood than it is in the lungs air, and that means it has its own gradient. CO2 has its own gradient that has nothing to do with oxygen's gradient, but it still is, by diffusion, going to go down its gradient. But down its gradient for CO2 means from the blood into the lungs. And they both happen at the same time. Now, you have air in the lungs that doesn't have as much oxygen in it, and it has a much higher amount of CO2 in it, and that's what you exhale. Okay? Now, the gas exchange has taken place, loading the blood of oxygen. Gas exchange at the lungs has taken place. This loads the blood with oxygen, and it gets rid of the CO2. So this is oxygen-rich blood, and that goes back to the heart via the pulmonary veins. It came to the lungs originally, I should have mentioned, through the pulmonary arteries. The pulmonary veins bring that blood back to the heart. And it brings it back to the left side of the heart, remember. Oxygenated blood goes into the left atrium, goes into the left ventricle, and then gets pumped through the aorta, through smaller and smaller arteries, until it eventually hits capillary beds in all parts of the body except the lungs. That's what this bottom capillary bed represents. So, at the systemic capillaries, and everything other than the lungs, the oxygen in that blood is pretty high, much higher than it is in the cells making up those tissues. And that's why oxygen, when it reaches the capillary at the systemic tissues, oxygen is going to go down its gradient from the blood into the cells of the body. Those cells need that oxygen for a complex set of reactions called glycolysis and cellular respiration. Now, that's a totally different use of the word respiration, but that's what's happening inside the cells. That's why we need oxygen. But that's why it gets to those cells. It's going down its gradient. At the same time, these cells, which have been undergoing these sets of reactions, are creating carbon dioxide. Where did the carbon dioxide come from? It's what's left over from the food that you ate when those food particles have been broken down completely for energy. So the CO2 is accumulating here, and that's why the CO2 level is higher in the tissue cells than it is in the blood coming to those cells. And once again, CO2 is going to travel down its gradient, but that means it's going to go from the cells into the blood. And this is what loads the blood with CO2, and the O2 has been taken out of the blood. So this now oxygen-poor blood and CO2-rich blood returns to the heart, eventually to the superior and inferior vena cava, into the right side of the heart for another trip to the lungs. It just happens over and over. Now, in 16, we can see what's called external respiration. That is the exchange of carbon dioxide as it's occurring in the lungs, or at the lungs, I should say, involving the capillaries and the alveoli like we were talking about. So this represents the respiratory membrane that we looked at in the earlier slide, except the basement membrane between the alveolus and the capillary is not shown here. Anyway, the new information here is that we have this chemical reaction shown here. And this is shown like it's a one-way reaction, but really these should be double arrows because it's a reversible reaction. It's just that it's occurring in the rightward direction in this slide. This is an important chemical reaction that I want to go over a little bit. I don't want to get bogged down too much in chemistry, but this HCO3 is bicarbonate ion. H plus is hydrogen ions, which causes acidity. H2CO3 is carbonic acid, and CO2 is carbon dioxide. H2O is water. Okay, now, in external respiration, oxygen is leaving the lungs, going into the blood. CO2 is being removed from the blood and going into the lungs. And notice that CO2 is one of the players in this, one of the chemicals that's involved in this chemical reaction. Now, when you take CO2 away from this, out of the situation, that's going to cause this reaction to move to the right to replace the CO2 that you're taking away. And in order for it to move right, that means you have to combine bicarbonate ion and hydrogen ions to make carbonic acid, which can then split into CO2 and water. When that happens, you'll replace the CO2 that's being removed. But the effect of that is that you're going to have less bicarbonate ions and less hydrogen ions. And when you make less hydrogen ion, or when you take hydrogen ions out of solution in order to make them into carbonic acid, that makes the plasma less acidic. And that less acidic plasma makes hemoglobin much more able to grab onto oxygen that's coming into the blood. So this is perfectly appropriate. You want the hemoglobin at the lungs to really grab onto oxygen well, because you're trying to load the blood with oxygen at this end. Okay, so keep that in mind. Now let's talk about what's happening at the other capillary beds in the rest of the body other than the lungs, the systemic capillaries. This is where so-called internal respiration is taking place. It's still exchange of carbon dioxide, but it's happening at the rest of the body other than the lungs, and it's reversed in terms of how things are traveling. Just like we showed in two slides ago, CO2 is entering the blood at the systemic capillaries. It's coming from the cells of the body, and it's going into the blood, and oxygen is leaving the blood and going into those cells. Okay, so when CO2 comes into the blood, this is the same chemical reaction, but it's just shown in the opposite direction in this way compared to the previous slide. So when you add carbon dioxide to this side, it's going to force this reaction to go in the other direction, but it's still, but in this case, it's toward the right as it's written here. That causes CO2 and water to combine to form carbonic acid, which then splits into bicarbonate ions and hydrogen ions. So the CO2 that comes into the bloodstream from the cells is going to cause more hydrogen ions to be released into the plasma. And that, by definition, makes the plasma more acidic. In that more acidic environment, the hemoglobin is much less able to hang on to the oxygen. And so this is what causes the oxygen to be released by the hemoglobin so that it can then diffuse into the cells of the body. And that's exactly what you want at this end. At the lung end, you wanted the hemoglobin to take that oxygen on. Now you want it to release the oxygen so that the cells of the body can have it. And that's caused by an acid or pH change based on whether CO2 is entering or leaving the blood. This, by the way, is exactly why you are able to hold your breath only up to a certain point. A lot of people think that when you cannot hold your breath any longer and you have to breathe, it's because you're out of oxygen. That's not true. There's still plenty of oxygen in your blood at that moment. But when you're no longer exhaling because you're holding your breath, the CO2 just keeps building up coming from the cells of your body. And that makes more and more hydrogen ions appear in your blood, which makes your blood more and more acidic. And the base of the brain, which gets bathed in blood because it receives blood just like the rest of the body, is really, really sensitive to an increase in acidity. So when these hydrogen ions start to build up and increase the acidity, the brainstem responds by forcing you to breathe. Okay, 18. Here we have the neural control of normal breathing. So there's a so-called breathing center in the base of the brain. This is the same base of the brain I was talking about that forces you to breathe when it senses the increase in hydrogen ions. So that's what's happening here. When CO2 increases, that increases hydrogen ions, and the brainstem recognizes that as a need to inhale. So it stimulates via motor neurons the diaphragm and the external intercostal muscles, which increase the volume of the rib cage, like we were talking about before. That causes inspiration. There's also breathing control centers that just allow this to happen over and over, inhalation and exhalation. And so you're normally not conscious of your breathing rate. You just, if you're sitting there and not talking, and not singing or anything else, all you're doing is not even thinking about breathing. It's you're just going to undergo tidal breathing, shallow, minimum breathing, in and out, over and over. It's kind of interesting that if you it becomes kind of hard to normally breathe if you think about it, because you're conscious of it all of a sudden, and so you kind of start breathing either too deeply or too shallow simply because you're thinking about it. But it all happens behind the scenes. One thing I haven't talked about is that there are also sensors in the aorta which send information to the brain that also contribute to this rhythmic breathing in and out. That is the chapter.